Arcs P 1039, it's Kate, and welcome to the first edition of Arcs P's On the Case with David McDivitt from McDivitt Law Firm. David, thank you for joining us.
Hey, Kate, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. We are once a month. David McDivitt is going to hang out with us here on Arcs P and answer your legal questions. So you can always submit your questions at 1039arcsp.com. You can also call us here in the studio. 219-7625. So we have some questions that we're going to get to. But first of all, David, how are you today? How was your weekend?
I'm doing well. I'm a dad. I've got two little kids. I had a good Father's Day with my kids. I got a mug from each of them.
Yeah.
You know, kind of world's greatest dad mugs, but without the words world's greatest dad. Just a dad.
So, hey, that works, right?
That works. No, they're cute, though. They're photos of my kids, and they're wonderful mugs. So
I love that.
I had a really good weekend. How about you?
I had a good weekend. I was actually talking about this earlier. You know, 2020 has been wild. I had my high school reunion, my 10-year, over Zoom. It was really weird.
Oh, wow. That would be, I hadn't even thought about reunions, but that's got to be different.
Yeah, it was weird because, like, we realized it was like we were back in class because nobody could really just talk whenever they wanted to. Everybody had to, like, raise their hand and be called on. It was wild. So it was a weird weekend, but 2020 is wild.
Have you kept up with a lot of those people from your class?
Not really, no.
Yeah.
So it was interesting. We were all just kind of recapping our 10 years, and we realized that's a long time to kind of talk about all individually, too.
Oh, that's a tough way to do it.
I know.
A lot less fun. I'm sorry.
Oh, it's all right. But that was my weekend. I know 2020 has been wild. We're going to talk a lot about that and, like, how it's kind of affected the legal system and what you deal with. But again, we're here with David McDivitt from McDivitt Law Firm for RXP's On the Case. Before we get into questions, David, can you give us a quick history lesson on McDivitt Law Firm, how long you guys have been serving Colorado?
You bet. Yeah. So McDivitt Law Firm was started by my dad and my mom, but predating the formation of the firm in its current name. You know, my dad started practicing in 1974, and he grew up in La Junta in the southeast part of the state. It's about an hour east of Pueblo. And my mom's from Los Animas. Well, they met, I'm not going to say when, but when they met, my dad was practicing. He had a solo practice in La Junta. And then they had that firm there. And then in 1988, they moved up to Colorado Springs from La Junta when I was 10 years old. Now, here I am accidentally dating my mom. I promised her I wouldn't do that. we had the firm here in Colorado Springs, and then have grown it really since the late 80s into a firm that has offices in Pueblo, Colorado Springs, Denver, and Aurora. You know, historically, in Colorado Springs, we've been, if not the largest law firm that's based in Southern Colorado. And our practice is exclusively injury-based work. So we represent people who, you know, have been injured in one form or another, typically in a car crash or motorcycle or trucking crash, or they're hurt on the job. And then obviously, very catastrophically, we represent family members of people who've been killed. And whether, again, that was in a car crash or because of a defective medical device or a bad drug, you know, we're in the business of helping people who've been hurt, who've lost loved ones, and holding the responsible party or company or entity accountable for the harm that they've caused to somebody. You know, we've branched out some. We have a very large presence in a water contamination lawsuit that's based out of Fountain Security in Whitefield, representing people who have personal injuries because of contaminated water from firefighting foam. And that's been something I've been very personally involved in for years now. But, you know, the bulk of it really is helping people on an individual basis who've been hurt. And so Karen and Mike, my parents, started this together. My dad's a lawyer. My mom's got her PhD in school psychology. But together they've kind of created this business. And, you know, I joined 13 years ago. Prior to that, I was a public defender in Pueblo. And I'd gone to a law school in Boulder, and prior to that, I was an investment banker in London. So I kind of had a different background before I got into the law.
Okay.
And then a handful of years ago, my little sister joined the firm, and she lives up in Denver and works out of our Denver office, and she runs our marketing. So if you see us on TV or you see billboards or on the bus, my sister's the one who coordinates all of that and comes up with a lot of the creative ideas. We've got a frog mascot now, so... The McDivitt frog. This is McDivitt.
Mm-hmm.
That was something that Lisa helped pioneer, and we've got stuffed frogs now, and my kids love them. So
I actually have. I'm holding one. I you can't see me, but I'm doing video. I'm holding one into the camera right now.
Oh, that's awesome. So. I'm glad I talked about it.
Very good. Very good. Well, thank you for
that, Kate.
You. Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you for all that you do, all that you and your family do. We really appreciate you doing this and giving people a chance to get some free legal advice. We're going to talk about 2020. What we realized was we got a lot of questions about COVID-19 and the pandemic. And we'll talk about that a little bit more coming up, but it's been a really crazy year. I mean, I can't imagine how it's affected the legal system and the work that you do.
It has been, you know, it's been one of these things where it's a moving target too. Not just I would say a pandemic perspective with the science, but also the impact that it's had on the court systems, which really kind of dictates how law firms operate in Colorado and its access to the courts. And so, you know, when things shut down, you know, the governor has issued, you know, over 100 orders now, all, you know, relatively all pandemic-based to a large extent. And a lot of those impact the court system.
Right.
You know, for example, the courts, you know, have remained relatively closed for almost all business. There are some emergency criminal procedures that still can get in front of somebody in person. Some child custody related issues on an emergency basis can be heard, but everything from the landlord tenant sphere to a typical civil jury trial have really been put on hold. So lawyers across Colorado have been forced, as most industries, to, you know, find new ways of doing things. And law firms are considered essential businesses, so we've been allowed to remain open even through the stay-at-home order. But a lot of firms, ours included, have moved to a remote model. So you really won't find a lot of law firms where you can actually just walk in and speak to somebody. Certainly for us, we're trying to keep our team members and our clients safe. But what we're doing now is a lot of, you know, obviously remote work, but a lot of video conferencing, like you did with your class reunion.
Yep.
We're doing mediations. We're doing depositions over Zoom. One of our attorneys just argued a case in front of the Colorado Court of Appeals using a WebEx interface, web video interface.
Wow.
So we had a work comp trial handled via video conference last week. So, I mean, the courts have adapted really quickly, which has been wonderful to see, to ensure that people continue to have access to the civil jury system and, you know, the criminal system, but I'm in the civil world. Which just forces us to be creative, and we're doing it. We're still, you know, cases are moving along. People are still getting a resolution with their legal matters. But you know, we've had to kind of think on our toes, and we were fortunate. I mean, our firm has been really on the cutting edge from a technology perspective for years. From the ability to work remotely, we've got, you know, everything is paperless and has been for close to a decade now with our firm. So it's been institutionalized within our system, and we're able to, you know, we were able to just, you know, move people off site extremely quickly and allow our clients to continue to have access to everybody virtually uninterrupted.
I think that's one thing that a lot of people are finding out is just how quickly we can adapt to what, you know, our circumstances around us.
Yeah.
And so it sounds like you guys have. I want to talk a little bit more coming up about like common questions that you've got during COVID-19, but we did have a question that was submitted online from Paige. It says, and I've actually heard this a lot, it's like a very common thing I've been hearing amongst my friends. I heard it a lot over the Zoom reunion over the weekend. A few people say this exact thing, but Paige wrote in, she was furloughed because of COVID, so she is collecting unemployment, but making more money than she was before. If
right.
She gets asked to come back to work and she says no, will she be ineligible for unemployment?
You know, that is, and Paige, that's a great question. So many people have that question because there are a lot of people who are actually making more money now on unemployment than they were before. So, you know, the short answer is you're pretty much going to have to continue to take steps to try to find employment if you are on unemployment. For a while, and frankly, I'm a little unclear, too. I spent a lot of time looking into this because the Division of Labor, if you go on the website, that's how you start processing your claim for unemployment benefits. It says that, you know, there have been updates and you're now required to, if you are on unemployment, continue to look for a job. There are certain conditions where maybe that won't work for you. Governor just issued an order on June 13th, which makes it look like he's continued to suspend the requirement to search for a job. And that's where there's a little bit of, I think, a lack of clarity. And maybe it's just my own inability to kind of sift through that. But you look at Executive Order 100 that Paula signed, it indicates there's language in there saying that he suspended the requirement that unemployment insurance benefit recipients actively seek work. Yet the website says that they now have to. And the reason that's relevant to Paige is if you already have a job, you've been furloughed, that means you can tell the unemployment office with a straight face, look, I don't need to be looking for work because I have one. They just can't let me come back yet. Well, when that employer says you can come back now, as the recipient of unemployment benefits, you do have an affirmative obligation to update every couple of weeks your status. And so the employer has recommended that they update it with unemployment, and also the furloughed employee needs to update the fact that their position has been kind of reopened. And assuming that it is, the same position, there's not been a material dock in pay or change in the work circumstances, and also further assuming that the employer is taking all reasonable steps to accommodate governor orders for a safe workplace to reduce any risk of COVID transmission, then, Paige would likely need to return to work, or basically say, I'm not going to return to that, but then have to then actively seek another job.
Okay.
Which, by the way, is hard to find. So
right.
It's, I think the best bet for her to do is to let them know that they have asked her to come back, and then she can explain why it doesn't make sense for her to go back to work. And then what the employment office usually will do is they'll speak to the employer, they'll speak to the employee, and make it a determination whether or not she's still eligible for those benefits.
Right. If she just, like, if they're calling her to ask her to come back and she just never answers the phone, she's like,
well,
I don't know, they want me back.
No, I know. Yes, all right.
I missed
crazy.
That call.
I was so busy trying to feed people, or
right.
I don't know what her excuse would be, but
totally missed that text.
Gonna have to do something about that.
Yeah. Well, I think that's.
Yeah.
Sorry, go on.
Well, just gonna say, speak to the office, which, by the way, is not always easy to do, because there's so many people applying for unemployment benefits. I mean, just getting into the system is hard. On the online system is hard. Good luck getting somebody on the phone. But you do have to update your information.
Okay. This is, honestly, it's like one of the first questions that we got in. And like I said, I feel like it's a very common thing amongst a bunch of people. So I think if Paige has this question, I think a lot of people out there did. And so that's good information for people to follow.
Well, and look, from an employer's perspective, too. I mean, the Wall Street Journal has written articles on it. New York Times has. Nationally, I mean, it's harder for these employers now who want to go back, kind of open their doors again to get their employees to come back.
Right.
Because the employees say, look, I've got a good gig here.
Yeah.
I'm making a little bit more money. Sometimes I'm making a lot more money. I don't have to go into work. I can be with my family.
Yeah, sit at home, play video games.
Yeah, play video games. That's a sensitive topic in my house right now.
Oh, is it?
I have a 6-year-old. What I did is when COVID hit, I had all these firm rules that I'd set. Like, my kids aren't going to play video games till they're 10.
Right.
Because that's how old I was when I got a Nintendo. I was 10. And, my son was 5 during the first part of COVID. He's 6 now. My daughter's 8. And I said, oh, my gosh, what are we going to do? I guess we're breaking that rule. We're going to get a video game machine. So I found an old Wii that I had, a Nintendo Wii, and I dusted it off. And now it's like crack cocaine.
I think that's the story of, COVID is all rules are kind of off.
They are.
Yeah. I think we're finally, after we're a few months into it, trying to, we're starting to figure out a routine a little bit. But at the beginning, it was like, all bets are off, I think.
Oh, no. It's crazy. I mean, I'm a single parent, so I'm trying to do, I'm working from home, and I've been taking care of my kids from home. I furloughed my nannies.
Yeah.
When this first hit, because I was home alone with the kids all the time. What used to be, again, firm and fast rules on screen time, for example, you know, X amount of minutes or an hour or whatever. But now it's just like, you know what, it's too much screen time if I think they're just not going to go to sleep at night.
Right.
And that's my new barometer. I'm like, I think another 5 hours is okay.
Absolutely.
Horrible. Like, kids, feed yourself. I'm trying to work.
Well, Paige, I hope that answers your question. I know a lot of people had that same question too, and so I think that's really good advice to follow. We're going to take a little bit of a break right now. We're going to come back with more questions for David McDivitt from McDivitt Law Firm. Again, this is RXP's On the Case, answering your legal questions. So we'll be back with David McDivitt in just a few minutes. Right now, it's Grandson on RXP. On RXP, it is RXP's On the Case with David McDivitt from McDivitt Law Firm. David, how are you?
I'm doing well, Kate. It's good to be back on the air.
Absolutely. Thank you for joining us today. Again, this is the first one. This is basically once a month. David McDivitt joins us to answer your legal questions. It's a chance for people to get free legal advice, which can be really helpful. So we appreciate you doing this.
Well, you're welcome. And sometimes I find people, some people think it's intimidating to reach out to a lawyer and ask questions. And so hopefully we can take some of that intimidation out of this and make it a more comfortable environment, a more fun environment, and really hit on a whole broad range of topics.
Absolutely. Well, thank you again for doing this. We've been talking a little bit so far about COVID-19 and how that has affected basically our entire worlds, right? Everybody's lives.
Everything.
And, it doesn't seem to be... I guess slowing down at any point, at least in terms of us getting back to normal. And so one of the things I definitely wanted to ask you about, what are some of the most common questions you have got during this time? We just in the last segment talked about Paige, who submitted a question, who had been furloughed and on unemployment, making more money on unemployment and wondering if she can basically refuse to go back to work. That seems like a common question that we got. Yeah. But on your side of it, what are the most common questions you've got during this time related to COVID?
Well, it kind of runs the gamut. I mean, a lot of the stuff, let's say, you know, go back to when COVID first really started to become a major issue. A lot of the questions I was dealing with had to do with employer and employee issues. You know, from an employer's perspective, you know, what am I allowed to do? What am I required to do? And what am I permitted to do with respect to restrictions on who can come in? And, you know, do I have to do testing? May I do testing? And when I say testing, I don't mean necessarily COVID testing, but temperature testing. And, you know, how do I restrict my work environment to keep people safe? Or as an employee, can my employer mandate that I submit to a temperature check, for example? And the answers change. It's evolved. As coronavirus has evolved, the answer to those questions has evolved too, where it used to be, you know, that the employer couldn't mandate a temperature check, to now the employer must, in most circumstances, do a temperature check. You know, can they mandate a mask? Now they must, in most circumstances, mandate masks. So, you know, that has changed. So the answers to these questions have changed, and the questions themselves have evolved too. I mean, as this unemployment system really kicked into gear, getting questions about, you know, how do I file for unemployment and what can I expect to get by way of benefits? You know, a lot of people for a while who were independent contractors who were kind of initially excluded from some of the CARES Act benefits, who then were subsequently eligible for it, would have questions about that. And then, you know, the other one, too, that we deal with just in our line of work, because we do represent people who have been injured, who can I sue if I contract coronavirus? And so you've got, I would say, two camps of people, one who are concerned that they might have been exposed or that they might potentially be put in a situation where they'll be exposed, and they want to know what kind of rights and recourses they have. And the others who have been exposed and who have contracted coronavirus. And with these infectious diseases, it's very difficult to pinpoint the source of exposure. And while an employee might be able to maintain a claim for workers' compensation if they contract coronavirus at work, it is a very steep hill to climb to prove that you contracted it at work. You know, take a situation where you've got somebody, you know, we were talking off the air about somebody who, they wear a mask at work, but not a lot of the other people who go to that same workplace wear masks, and it doesn't seem like the employer has really done much to enforce a mask rule. Well, if that person contracts coronavirus, you know, it might be a little bit easier to prove that they got it at work because of the prevalence of of unmasked colleagues, but it's still a difficult challenge.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you cannot just sue your employer. They have a workers' compensation system in place to allow you to pursue benefits that you're entitled to if you do get hurt at work or if you are, you know, exposed to an infectious disease. But you can't really, in the traditional sense, you know, take somebody to court, take your boss to court. We just don't have that system generally in America.
And it could get awkward.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and that's kind of why, too. I mean, the law, and this goes back to our, you know, English common law that we adopted here in the United States, and it goes back to the Industrial Revolution. It says, you know, when you go to work, there's some inherently dangerous aspects to any work environment. And you kind of accept the fact that you might get hurt at work, and while they don't let you sue your employer, they do have a system in place for you to get benefits if you are injured. And that's usually kind of through a private insurance company, or in Colorado we have quasi-governmental insurance programs like Pinnacle that will step into that place. And then we have a workers' compensation administration that oversees that the state-run program. So, you know, there are avenues in place if you do get hurt, but, you know, exposure to coronavirus is a little different. And then also, you know, the other area where we see it too is nursing homes. And you see a report just came out that, you know, I think half the nursing homes in Colorado have been cited for lax coronavirus safety protocols. And, you know, there are these residents of these nursing homes, and these nursing homes are a tinderbox for the spread of infectious disease. And so these nursing homes have a real strong obligation, a heightened obligation to do whatever they can to help prevent the spread, help prevent the entry of an infectious disease, and then help prevent the spread of it if it does get into the nursing home. And, you know, I've long maintained through this coronavirus period that it's kind of hard to fault a nursing home for the coronavirus coming in, because, you know, we've seen just where this coronavirus can sneak in almost anywhere. However, when it is there, these nursing homes have an obligation to really follow the protocols to ensure that spread doesn't take place, and that's not necessarily happening. And we're seeing a lot of residents fall ill, and many of them die because of coronavirus. It's scary.
In your experience, you know, I'm this is like the first kind of, well, it is the first pandemic I've been through. You know, there was swine flu, but I was, you know, younger and didn't really pay attention. Is this all very new for you guys to deal with? I know that COVID is a very unique situation, but have you guys dealt with a lot of this kind of same stuff before?
You know, to some extent, there's something that's novel about it in the sense of kind of the mass vulnerability, I think, that most of us have. But, you know, you look at more of at the institutional level, at the insurance level. You know, the insurance companies have been aware for years about the risks of things like swine flu. And because of swine flu, you know, the H1N1, you've got the various things over the last 20 years, for example, that really put insurance companies on notice that these infectious diseases are out there, and the problems that they can create. And so we see that when it comes to what I call business interruption claims for businesses that had to shut down because of government orders mandating closure. You know, and restaurants are a prime example of that. You know, they were forced to shut down. And so many of them, either whether restaurants or otherwise, have seen just such a reduction in business that a lot of them have tried to make claims with their insurance companies. There are commercial insurance companies for business interruption or loss of business income. And these insurance companies have thrown their hands up and said, oh, man, you know, we can't, you know, we can't protect against that, or we can't insure against that. And you know, we cry foul on a lot of that because they've been on notice that that this is out there and can be a real risk. And they continue to take premiums. And oftentimes they don't have a specific virus exclusion in their policies. And, I think these businesses might be entitled to recover on these claims. So, you know, in that sense, you know, in our world, in the litigation world of trying to hold folks accountable for premiums that they've collected and claims that they refuse to pay out on, or people who are negligent and completely fail to follow the appropriate standards of care to ensure that their customers or their patients or their clients are safe, it's not new. And we've seen this kind of stuff. It's unfortunate that I think more wasn't done at the regulatory level, at the federal level even, to try to keep keep this from coming in. And you know, we had a lot of programs that had been eviscerated prior to January, and I think that could have helped to stem the tide of this. And so, you know, that's frustrating. But, you know, we're all just trying to do what we can, you know, at our law firm, but not just our firm, but, I mean, at law firms across the country, to try to help take care of people who get caught in a really bad place because of this.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's 2020 has been a year that we're never going to forget, right?
Oh, I know. I mean, those memes, too, that come out. Like, yeah. These crazy things that are going to happen next, and it's just...
Right. Like, no thanks. Well, we do have some non-COVID-related questions coming up, but we're going to take another quick break real quick. Again, with David McDivitt from McDivitt Law Firm for RxP's On the Case. We have a couple more questions coming up. You can always submit your questions for free legal advice at 1039rxp.com, but more coming up on RxP. RxP 1039, it's Kate, and on with David McDivitt from McDivitt Law Firm for RxP's On the Case. We have a couple non-COVID related questions. David, thank you again for doing this and answering our questions today. It's very helpful, people that need that advice out there.
Well, I'd like to do what I can. I don't have all the answers, but if I think that I can help, I'm really happy to.
Yeah. Well, we're glad that you're here with us today for RxP's On the Case. Again, if you ever want to submit a question, you can do so at 1039rxp.com. You can call us here in the studio, 219-7625. We've been taking COVID-related questions, but a couple that are non-COVID-related. We got this question from our website from Elizabeth. This is a landlord question, a rent question. She said, what is the requirement from a landlord to make repairs? We've asked our landlord several times since November to fix our door that got damaged by the wind. They've also done a walkthrough twice since then and haven't fixed it. If they don't fix it before we move out, can they try to make us pay for it to be fixed? A lot there, but what do you think?
Yeah, a lot there, but it's pretty easy to unpack this issue. And this is pretty common, you know, for tenants where they live in a place, they think that the landlord isn't doing enough to fix certain things. Now, the landlord generally has an obligation to provide a habitable rental unit. And so if there is a broken door, and broken doors are specifically listed as something that just can't be allowed to exist. So that they need to have unbroken windows and doors. As a tenant, what you really need to do is put them on written notice of the problem. And so I don't know with Elizabeth what kind of notice that she's given the landlord. It's really not enough to tell them to call them, or even if they do a walkthrough to point it out. It needs to be documented. Now, ideally, you'd have a landlord that you could call and say, hey, my door's broken, and they'd get over and they'd fix it for you.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, not every landlord does that. And whether it's because of just the sheer number of rental units that landlord owns or manages, or they just don't care, or they're just kind of mean, one way or the other, you know, you do have some rights as a tenant. So, you know, put them on notice. You know, I think, you know, I've there are requirements for how you put a landlord on notice, and that usually is in writing. I always, in every capacity of the law, I always say, you know, get this in writing. If you're going to send a letter, send it certified. Have it some way of documenting that landlord has received it. Then, you know, if they refuse to fix it, you know, as I understand it, you know, the tenant usually can fix the door themselves. They have to do it in a workmanlike manner. That means they can't just do a shoddy job of it, but they have to get it really fixed.
Put some duct tape on it.
Right, exactly.
That's what I would do.
You know, and then they can submit a bill to the landlord. Hopefully the landlord pays it. But, and I'm kind of going in the general terms here. And then at that point, the tenant can kind of withhold the amount subject to certain limitations for the cost of that repair. So in Elizabeth's case, you know, she's worried that they're going to take the repair cost out of their damage deposit.
Right.
Putting the landlord on notice that, hey, this is what it's going to cost. Well, first of all, it's broken. It needs to be fixed. And then as the tenant, hire somebody, or not hire them, they'll come out and give you a bid usually for free. Get somebody to come out and give you a bid on what it would cost to fix or replace the door. Get a written copy of that. And if you want to be just super detailed, you know, get three separate estimates of what it's going to cost to repair this door. I think that's overkill. I don't think you really need to do that. but you know, that never hurts. And then submit those to the landlord and say, look, landlord, this is what it's going to cost to repair this door. Would you please do this? And if you don't do this, you know, by the way, you're in violation of our this rule that you have to make sure that we live in a safe place. You know, you may be eligible for, you know, getting out of your lease at some point if this continues. But again, there are specific rules, and it's a very regimented process for both the tenant and the landlord as far as what they can do to either get out of a lease or get some reduction in rent. But as a landlord, Elizabeth, I mean, as a tenant, you can't just unilaterally withhold some money. You've got to follow certain steps. And I always recommend people talk to a specialist in landlord and tenant law. There are lawyers out there who really focus, you know, on that whole general category of the law, or they focus more on tenant issues or landlord issues. But they'll kind of explain what you really need to do that. But putting the landlord on notice, getting an estimate of what it's going to cost, and if you don't want to be the one to fix it, and the landlord won't, at least you're protected if they try to take that money out at the conclusion, unless they can prove that you're the reason that the door is broken.
Yeah.
You know, it's one thing to say the wind did it, but, I mean, if it's got a boot mark in it.
Right.
And that boot mark matches your boot mark, you know, we've got... Kate, you know, you've got your detective.
That's where I was just about to say, that's where I come in.
That's right.
And investigate.
On the case. Two of us, we're going to be out there with magnifying glasses. That's a size 11 shred.
Oh, man. Like, talking about this issue, I've been renting for a long time, and I've had landlords of all types. One time, our door got, we like literally got broken into. It wasn't here, it was back in Kansas, but our landlord was there in like 2 hours and put on an entirely new door. I think it was because we had just moved in like 2 days before, and so he was probably like, please don't associate that with my place.
Yeah, exactly.
He's like, I feel horrible about this.
No, yeah, you can get, I mean, look, the world is full of great landlords.
Yeah.
And I've had some great landlords in my day, and I've had some pretty bad ones too, you know. But it's tough too, because as a tenant, I mean, you feel so vulnerable. You know, and you want to, so many tenants want to, they take such pride of ownership and stuff that they don't own, you know, and they want to make it look nice. And then, you know, hopefully the landlord supports that. And I've seen some landlords that come in and say, well, you know, thanks for, you know, beautifying my property, but, you know, time for you to get out now.
Yeah.
And it's tough. It's a delicate balance. But, you know, I just see moving more and more to a landlord tenant world where fewer people are buying homes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a change in, you know, the economic demographics of our country too.
Absolutely.
But yeah.
Well, I hope that helps, Elizabeth. I want to ask this question too. This is another non-COVID related question.
Yeah.
But a very Colorado question. This question was submitted anonymously. I think rightfully so.
Asking for a friend kind of thing.
Asking for a friend. Totally wasn't me. That sounds like I submitted this. I did not.
I shouldn't make that joke.
But this question was submitted to our website anonymously. It said, I shipped some Colorado THC mints to a friend out of state through UPS. My friend has not received them, and the shipping tracking number comes up as unavailable. I did not put my name anywhere on the package. Should I go to UPS and ask where it is or file some...
Keep going. The answer to all this is no.
Okay, then she asks asks where it is or file for some form of insurance. No. She said, she or he said, could a dog have uncovered what I was shipping?
Yes.
Or then the last question is, should I never do this again?
Yes. So the answer to that is yes.
No, yes, and yes.
Okay, so from a lawyer's perspective, these questions they're great, because a lawyer can finally, like, you can, with a great degree of certainty, I can answer this question. So many questions in the law, you know, there's ambiguity, and there are different ways things can be argued. But when it comes to the interstate drug trade and narcotic trafficking and trying to be your own episode of Narcos, Colorado, which, by the way, have you ever seen that show?
I haven't, no.
Oh, my gosh. So I'm hooked. It's Netflix. They've got Narcos, which had dealt with Pablo Escobar and the Colombian drug trade. And then they created a follow-up series called Narcos Mexico, which starts with the marijuana trade out of Mexico, and then it morphs into the cocaine trade. But this is Narcos light, basically. Trying to ship pot or pot-related stuff from Colorado to some other place in the United States where presumably pot isn't legal for recreational use or you know, medicinal use. So the short answer is no, this is highly illegal. And it's illegal, you know, 8 ways till Sunday. So let's assume that because your package didn't make it to your friend, that it was confiscated. So if it's been confiscated, the last thing you want to do is go in there and try to get it back from them.
Wear like the glasses with the big nose and the mustache.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
It wasn't.
But here's the other thing, though, too. Even if it got to your person, so the person who wrote this in, if you were listening, I hope that you are, because I've got some good advice for you. If they got to your buddy, wherever your buddy is, that does not mean you're actually in the clear. Oftentimes, postal inspectors will allow this stuff to go through the mail because, one, they're setting up a sting. Two, they want to just have this information in their back pocket so that a little bit later, if you do this again or they want to get you on a bigger charge, they've got some leverage. So don't assume that if you or anybody who's listening to this, if you're in the business of mailing pot or any kind of controlled substance in the mail, that because it got to the person to whom you intended it, that you're in the clear. You're not necessarily in the clear. That said, this happens a lot. More of it gets through undetected than detected, but it's still risky as heck. And, you know, this person shipped it through UPS, maybe thinking that it's because it's a private company. It's not the same as mailing it through the United States Postal Service. You actually have fewer protections, believe it or not. If you mail through UPS, because it's a third party, they have the right to unilaterally open up your package under the Constitution. You don't have the Fourth Amendment protections that you do if you mail it through the Postal Service. So if the Postal Service thinks that it's pot, they still need to get a warrant to open it. UPS doesn't need that warrant. So, you're looking at prison terms because it's a federal crime. We're not talking about just a state issue here. When you start mailing stuff, you're committing a federal crime. Mm. So, you know, steep fines, prison. For first offense. Steeper fines, more prison for second offense. And that's assuming that it's a low amount of...
Yeah. In this instance, it was THC mints. Like, does it right. matter what it is or...
No, it doesn't.
No? Okay.
Because even in the concentrates, any of this, because it's still a controlled substance. The only kind of carve-out that I'm aware of is hemp. Certain hemp products, if they're being shipped from a person with a license to ship hemp, but it has to be noted. In that situation, you're noting that it's hemp. You've got a license to do it. Everybody knows you're shipping hemp. The shipper knows it too. And again, there are a bunch of little things that go along with this. But please, if you're listening out there, let it go.
Those
mints are gone.
This never happened.
Don't try. And the other thing is, too, so many people try to obscure who sent it, right? They didn't put their name on it. There's no return address. Well, that's good, but they can oftentimes still track who did it. And believe me, your person, your buddy on the other end, if they get busted and they put the squeeze on, you know, you're not going to remain anonymous. They're going to know who you were.
So when this person asks at the end, should I never do this again?
The answer is an
unequivocal yes.
Yes, you should okay. never do that again. I don't know if you'll listen, but don't.
I would listen to your advice, though.
Yeah, but those are that is a quintessential Colorado question.
Absolutely, I saw that one. I was like, yeah, we got to talk about this.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we're almost out of time here. Again, with David McDivitt from McDivitt Law Firm for ARCSP's On the Case. This is where you submit your legal questions and get some free legal advice. So, David, want to thank you so much for taking the time today. We're going to do this again. So if you didn't get your questions in, you can submit them at 1039rxp.com. David, anything else you want to throw out before I let you go for today? I know we have the 4th of July coming up.
4th of July, yeah.
And so we have a lot of transplants here in Colorado. Like, I'm from Kansas, and it's like fireworks, do it for like 2 weeks. It's kind of annoying. But
it's a little different in Colorado.
So can you kind of inform or remind everybody about Colorado firework, 4th of July laws?
Yeah, you bet. And I actually called the El Paso County Sheriff's Office this morning to just verify that the 2020 regulations will be the same as 2019. For the most part, that they will be. So if you're unfamiliar with it, in El Paso, so Colorado basically prohibits any kind of firework that leaves the ground, the Roman candles, the M80s, the kind of stuff that you could put next to an action figure and blow it up. That's just illegal across the board. Bottle rockets, totally illegal. And there are some cities, municipalities, Colorado Springs included, which bans all forms of fireworks, even those that stay on the ground. If you light it with a match in Colorado Springs, it's illegal. However, El Paso County allows some of those that stay on the ground. And so it's always been kind of the dichotomy between Colorado Springs and El Paso County and some of these other municipalities. So if you're in the county, unincorporated El Paso County, you can get away with, you know, those little tanks that shoot off sparks and the mm-hmm. sparklers and kind of the stuff that you'll pick up at a normal fireworks stand in the perimeter of Colorado Springs, for example. But if you're in the city of Colorado Springs, I don't know the rule on Pueblo. I need to check that. But generally, if it goes up in the air, it's totally illegal. And, you know, the police, they are out usually from the 3rd to the 5th of July, really patrolling for this. And then they're, you know, asking for neighbors, if you hear it, to call in. So be smart about it.
Yeah. That's it. Yeah, I grew up in Kansas, and my birthday is at the end of June, and I remember always having fireworks on my birthday, because it seemed like it was just a massive difference when I moved out here from what I grew up with, because it was like 2.5 weeks around the 4th of July, it was firework time where I was from, so it was very different.
I grew up in Colorado, and I mean, even in high school, I had buddies who had all sorts of stuff that's just, I guess it's totally illegal.
Yeah.
But I mean, it was throughout the year, we'd be blowing stuff up.
Right.
But you got to be careful.
Nope.
So, and that's illegal. So
yeah.
I'm not naming their names nor naming mine. But
I was scared of fireworks when I was little. I would only do the little, like, the white rocks things that you throw on the ground and they pop. I was going to say pop rocks, but that's a candy.
No,
it's not that. But I can't remember.
Those are legal. They're totally legal.
That's what those are my go-to, at least when I was a kid. A little braver now, but. well, that's good advice. I know there's a lot of transplants out here in Colorado. It's different out here maybe than where you're from. So it's good to have that reminder with the 4th of July coming up in just a few weeks. But unfortunately, we're out of time for the first RXP on the case. But David, again, with David McDivitt from McDivitt Law Firm, want to thank you so much for taking the time to answer our questions.
Thanks, Kate. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. If you ever want to submit a question, we're going to do this again at the end of July. You can submit at 1039rxp.com. You can also always call us here in the studio and get your question in. David, again, thank you so much for doing this. And I won't talk to you before this, but have a happy 4th of July.
Hey, happy 4th to you as well, Kate. Stay safe.
You too. All right. Thank you so much.